It'd be nice to have you read some poems.
Okay.
Do you want to start with Walking the Dog? Okay. Can you tell us, can you give us a little heads up about how you were inspired to write that and maybe your practice of writing epigrams?
Well, a number of these just sort of popped up in my writing, you know, at different times. And I collected them together as a broadsheet, which was published. This funny guy had a place called Multicultural Books. He would literally go door to door selling poetry. It would take him about a year to cover Vancouver. And he had maps and he had notations of who had bought poetry from him in the past. So naturally, when he came to my house, I'd buy some poetry. And at one point, I suggested maybe you'd like to publish this broadsheet of aphorisms. And he jumped all over it. So he did 1,000 of them, and he sold them for $1 apiece, and sold them out. Well, the first 1,000 I designed, and it was on paper of my choosing, and I thought it was quite handsome. The second 1,000, I added some pieces, and he designed it, and I thought it was pretty ugly. And I didn't really pay too much attention to how it sold. Later, I just kept writing them on a kind of one-time basis. I collected them together, and I thought, oh, well, I'll add on to the second edition. And that's how this came about. Probably the first edition would have been in, probably in the 90s. And the second, and this edition is 2000 and, oh, yeah, it says here, 96, first edition, second edition, 2013.
Well, read a few so we can get a sense.
Okay. Nothing ever changes. Everything changes. Nothing remains the same except nature. Always changing. Always the same. Human nature, in infinite perversity, clothes its motives with ambiguity and misdirection. Even from itself. All the forces of the universe conspire to produce the tiny, insignificant, ordinary events of the present.
That sounds straight out of Huayan Buddhism or Alfred North Whitehead. That's amazing. Is some of your philosophy, obviously your philosophy is coming through in this, but there seems to be a real Zen feel.
Yeah, what I say, actually, and it's become a kind of a saying rather than a truism, maybe, but I say originally I was influenced by existentialism. Like when I was in high school, I was reading all these existentialists, and when I went to college, I thought, I'm going to take courses in existentialism. But of course, there was no such thing. What I say is that existentialism looks at the world, finds it absurd, and it's reason for despair. So that was in my youth. Then at a certain point, I got interested in Zen. And Zen looks at the world, sees that it's absurd, and gets busy washing the dishes. And my third phase, I got interested in Dada. Dada looks at the world, sees it's absurd, and has a good laugh.
All right.
So I've considered myself, certainly as in the visual arts, as a Dadaist for a number of decades. Uh-huh. My Zen phase was, you know, maybe 8 years or something like that. Maybe more, I don't know.
Please read some more of the poems.
The future flows inevitably from the torrent of the present. Without commitment, nothing really extraordinary can be accomplished. The most important truths are the simplest and most transparent.
Which reminds me of Charles Olson, who said, I've had to learn the easiest things last.
Yeah. Picasso said it took him a whole lifetime to learn to draw like a child.
There's a Picasso in your old neighborhood, the exhibit at the Vancouver Art Gallery right
That's
now.
Right. It is impossible to remember the twists and turns of your lies, but you don't have to memorize the truth. Technology is just a useless toy unless you have something important to say. Language is humanity's most precise and powerful tool.
Now, we'll go back to the technology part. You're writing this in the 90s, and here we are in 2016 with people chasing Pokemon figures off cliffs and whatever, getting shot going into people's homes. And so, I mean, we are inundated. You know, it's the information age, and we are inundated with just incredibly useless shit. And it's been an avalanche since you wrote that poem.
That's true. But, you know, you become selective.
Right. The information age brings on the consciousness age, and now many people need guides to help them filter out what's designed to get in their pocket, into their pocketbook, and what's designed to actually help them be successful, as you describe it, what success is.
Yeah. An interesting sideline, like a lot of these are, they use simple linguistic tools like inversion, repetition. They're not really complex in most of them. Poetry is the anvil on which the evolution of language is forged. I really believe that poetry is our best writing, and it's poet's job to change the language, to make mistakes, to make errors, to twist syntax and grammar around. But that's part of the poet's job, to say things in ways that they haven't been said before. That's just an aside. So one of the... So this moves from sort of from time, then it gets into a little section on poetry, and then it moves into art, ideas about art. So one of these is, art is ideas made visible. As I was doing poetry, I also was always quite good at visual art. And at a certain point in my life, I guess it would be in the 80s, or 70s even, I became quite enamored of conceptual art. Part of conceptual art is that the documentation becomes the work, in some sense. The work is ephemeral, but the documentation, whether it's verbal, written, or photographic, becomes like the art itself. So, anyhow, this book moves into the visual arts. My skills in the visual arts had always served me very well in the printing industry, as you can imagine. Because when I was in the printing industry, everything was done by paste-up, sort of graphically. And when you do books and things, you have to design the books. You have to design the cover. Graphic design is an intrinsic part of the look and feel of a book. In 1988, up to that point, I'd considered myself a professional poet. If anybody ever asked me to do a reading, I'd always say, well, is there a fee? You know, like I tried to be professional, I'd sell the books. But in 1988, I did a bunch of readings in the late 80s, and occasionally 12 people would show up. And I thought, this doesn't make sense. It's hard to be professional when 12 people show up, to take it as a profession. So I sort of decided, instead of being a professional poet, I'd become an amateur poet, and I'd try to be more professional in my artwork. So I sort of claimed that I became an artist. Of course, I never gave up poetry, but I don't really pretend anymore to be a professional in the sense that I could make money from it. The Canada Council does have a fee for readings, so you can make a little money, but I one time pointed out that in the arts, if you had a one-man show every month and a group show every week, you'd make about $20,000 a year. And the same is true in poetry.
It's worse than poetry.
Yeah, it's worse, really. But it's impossible to have a one-man show every month. And it's impossible to do, you know, to do a Canada Council reading. Like, you'd have to do four Canada Council readings a month.
Yeah, not going to happen.
And you wouldn't even make the minimum wage.